All right, ladies and gentlemen, one of the big stories of our time was the death of Antonin Scalia at this highly charged political moment in our history as we're going through the primary process of selecting nominees for the two parties. And of course, this is one of the single, I guess, short of taking the nation into war. There is no decision that is more profound by any president than who he or she would appoint to the United States Supreme Court. To talk to us about this now is the dean of the UC Irvine School of Law and the author of The Case Against the Supreme Court. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show Professor Erwin Chemerinsky. Professor Chemerinsky, good morning.
It's great to talk with you.
Appreciate you coming on. Yesterday, we spoke with Dr. John Eastman from Chapman Law School, who was your ideological opposite. And we wanted to hear from you as well, because this is my take, and I'm not a lawyer. I'm not pretending to be one or any way, shape, or form. But the Constitution clearly gives President Obama not only the authority, but an obligation to bring forward a nominee to the bench. And the Constitution also gives the Senate the tools with which to scuttle that if they want. So I don't think that there's a morality here. I just think there's a political standoff.
Well, I think it's too soon to know whether there's a standoff. President Obama has not yet nominated anyone, so it's premature for anyone to say they're going to oppose before knowing who the nominee is. My hope is that President Obama will nominate someone of impeccable credentials, and that at least enough Senate Republicans will want to join the Democrats to confirm that individual.
Well, we're in this situation now where it's government by, for, and about cloture votes, because we rarely see things passed on straight majority rules votes anymore, because just getting them to the floor for a vote usually requires 60 votes in the Senate, and this would require 14 Republicans to cross the aisle to allow a vote to go forward. And the problem is, of course, that with one-third of the Senate up for re-election, you've got senators who have to do the political calculus that if they vote to send this nomination forward, does it hurt them or help them?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And I think you've also got to focus on some of the Republicans who are from swing states, like Illinois, who are up for re-election. And if they oppose someone of impeccable credentials, what might be the political cost? So everyone has tried to stake out positions before knowing who the nominee is. Isn't the appropriate thing to see who does President Obama put forward? And then let's talk about whether that person's qualified and whether that person should be confirmed.
The president has said he is obviously going to make this. Just, I can't imagine a president not doing it. What president wouldn't want to have three picks on the court? So, of course, he's going to put a name forward, and then the fight will get more real because there'll be a vetting process. And certainly there's a lot of people out there who would be candidates, including people that the Senate has approved 97-0 with Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz voting to confirm. So there are appellate court judges who would certainly fit that definition. Can I ask you a tactical question? Because obviously this is a big deal because the court right now, ideologically, is a 4-4 tie. If assuming that the president can pick a judge who shares his political philosophy, it would be a 5-4 swing to the liberal side. But we all know that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has had health issues. She's elderly. And her time on the court, presumably, if you look at actuarial tables, isn't that long. It occurs to me that the way for this to be locked in, not knowing what's going to happen in the November election, would be for Ruth Bader Ginsburg to also announce her retirement contingent upon confirmation of a replacement. And that way the president could have two picks and could lock in the liberal majority past the November election.
I don't think Justice Ginsburg is going to do that, in part because she's not ready to step down. In part also, it would create chaos to have the possibility of having two vacancies at the same time. Now, you said she should do so conditional, but imagine that a Republican wins in November. I don't think she wants to have the possibility that she can help it. A Republican nominee will take her seat. So I think President Obama has this pick to fill. There can always be unforeseen circumstances. We saw that on Saturday. But otherwise, I don't expect he'll have another pick to fill.
Okay. What is the legacy from your perspective of Antonin Scalia?
think it's too soon to assess what his legacy will be. We'll know that only years and decades from now. I think we can see what his impact has been over the last 30 years. I think he has brought conservative judicial activism to the court. Prior to his arrival, for decades, conservatives on the Supreme Court were about restraint, deferring to the government and the political process. I think Justice Scalia brought a different vision of conservatism. His conservatism struck down laws regulating guns, struck down laws that regulated campaign finance, struck down federal statutes regulating guns near schools, allowing victims of gender violence to sue. So I think this is a very important change, and he was at the center of it.
When you have, when William Rehnquist was still on the court, he dominated the court. And in a lot of ways, Scalia has been the tail that wags the dog on the Supreme Court since he's been there. He's been a powerful force. When you lose somebody like that, I know it depends on a million intangibles, but is it just because John Roberts is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court? Is this an opportunity for Roberts to assert himself and to take over that leadership role, even from a minority position?
Well, Roberts has been the leader on the court since he came onto it in 2005. We refer to this not as the Scalia Court or the Ginsburg Court, but as the Roberts Court. That's not in any way to lessen the importance of Justice Scalia over the last 30 years. I think by virtue of his powerful intellect, his powerful rhetoric, he has played an enormously important role. I do think that leaves a vacuum on the court. Ultimately, who's going to be the leader is going to depend on who's got the votes. And that's why this seat and who fills it is so important.
We're talking with Professor Erwin Chemerinsky, who is the dean of the UC Irvine School of Law. He's the author of the book, The Case Against the Supreme Court. Talk to us about the role of the Chief Justice. What is it that the Chief Justice does that makes that position so powerful?
If the Chief Justice is in the majority, the Chief Justice assigns who writes the opinion. That's so crucial. Also, the Chief Justice plays the key role in setting the conference list as to what cases the court's going to consider taking up. The Chief Justice presides over oral argument. It's often been said that the Chief Justice is the first among equals.
So if the Chief Justice is in the minority, who writes the majority opinion? Who gets to decide who writes the majority opinion?
The most senior associate justice who's in the majority assigns the opinion if the Chief Justice is dissenting. So up until Saturday, if Justice Scalia was in the majority, but the Chief was not in the majority, Justice Scalia would assign the majority opinion. If Justice Kennedy joins with the four liberal justices with the Chief in dissent, then Justice Kennedy assigns who writes the majority opinion.
The fight that you see, this political fight that we see shaping up with Mitch McConnell saying nothing's coming forward and the president saying we're going forward. And I see people like Charles Schumer of New York saying absolutely is shaking the Constitution of people. And then, you know, we've already played the tape where he was saying no Bush appointment should be approved 18 months out from the end of President Bush's term. I don't believe that there's any. I believe that everybody's a hypocrite on this issue because everybody would reverse themselves if the situation were reversed politically. And this notion that the Supreme Court is above politics is true to a point. But on the other hand, I've always looked at it as maybe the most political court because you're dealing with political philosophy. That's ultimately you're dealing with interpretation of broad principles of American law, and that comes organically from the jurist perspective.
Of course, I think the problem is the word political has different connotations and different meanings. In many ways, the Supreme Court's not political. They're not elected. They don't have to face re-election.
Right.
They don't have to raise money to be elected. No one lobbies the Supreme Court justices. So far as we know, unlike politicians, they don't trade votes with one another. But if what we mean by political is they deal with political issues, if we mean by political that it's about the values and ideology of the office holders, of course it's political.
Hey, listen, thank you so much, Professor. We always appreciate you coming on with us. Professor Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean at UC Irvine School of Law. Let's go get some dependable KBC traffic. Here's Bill Thomas.